Just a quick note before we begin. This episode is from a live stream from May 21st, 2024, with Dr. Leon Edelman. Dr. Edelman is an entrepreneur and an expert on how VC or venture capital is reshaping specialty physician groups, including emergency medicine and anesthesia. We've distilled this session down to deliver the highest value insights in a shorter format. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Pemba On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare career development, and healthcare leadership. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries, most of whom graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional advice. The views and opinions expressed by the host and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization. By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to these terms. Whether you're sipping your morning coffee, commuting to the hospital, or just looking for a dose of inspiration, we've got you covered. We hope you will take full advantage of these practical, insightful, and relevant discussions designed to help physician leaders get new and build upon existing leadership skills and perspectives. Pemba On Demand will allow you to be an even bigger force for good in healthcare.
I'm very pleased to have as our guest on the show today, Dr. Leon Edelman. Leon is a fellow Pemba alumnus graduating in 2016 from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. Dr. Edelman is also an emergency medicine physician, the CEO and co-founder of Ivy Clinicians, and he's also established a community of emergency physician and APP emergency medicine providers, really, that he provides content to in the form of a newsletter and has had a podcast in the past. So Leon, I'm very, very pleased to welcome you to Pemba On Demand today.
Well, Norm, it's an honor to be here and I love Pemba, so happy to discuss anything Pemba related.
So maybe you could start out by just telling us a little bit about Ivy Clinicians and what prompted you to start that company and what is the focus of it?
Yeah, so Ivy Clinicians is a marketplace simplifying the emergency medicine job search through transparency. The company basically came out of years and years of saying somebody should do this, right? So I finished residency and I looked for my first job, and this was in 2011. I was looking for jobs in the DC area. And I figured, you know, you could just sort of pull up a list through Google or whatever of emergency medicine practices within driving distance of Washington, D.C. And there was nothing there in 2011. And then I moved to Nashville, you know, 5-6 years later, still nothing there. Then I was a medical director and wanted to, you know, it was a challenge to recruit. So I wanted to be on, or I wanted our emergency department and our practice to be on wherever it was after watching what was happening on the nursing side. So lots of really innovative nursing staffing tech companies growing rapidly during the pandemic. So watching that, I was like, finally, it's time to be the person that creates this. And we jumped in, created the business August of 2021. And we've been growing ever since.
Great. So when you started this, did you market this to emergency providers to sign up, or did you look at employers to post jobs on your website, or a combination?
Yeah, great question. So with any marketplace, there's this chicken and egg problem, right? So we're not selling a product. We're not really selling a service. What we're selling is the connection to the other side of the market, which means that you have to have the other side of the market there for the first side to want to be there. And so we had a few hypotheses. One is the doctors were the harder side of the market and the more valuable side of the market. They're the fish, if you will, and the recruiters are the fisher people. And so we had to figure out a way to get the doctors there. And the thing that we were trying to build for the doctors is this map of emergency medicine. So connecting every emergency department to its emergency medicine employer, which had never been done, but then connecting the employer to the recruiter. So what we knew we couldn't do is connect with all, there are 5,700 ERs in the country, connect with the in-house recruiters for 5,700 ERs and get them to be there, right? So we had to hack that and spend a kind of ridiculous amount of time getting the identification and then email addresses of every in-house emergency medicine in-house recruiter in the country. And so we kind of hacked that side of the market, and then that started bringing in the physicians who could then apply to jobs at any emergency department.
So has your process changed as you've grown over the last 3 years? Are you providing a subscription for the provider side and just using public domain information for the recruiting side? Or have you now started to find some companies or recruiting firms that are paying for access to your database?
Yeah, good question. So the good news with marketplaces is that they build on network effects. So at the beginning, we had to hack all this together. And the best way to describe the process was data janitorial work, where it was not any more glamorous than spending an inordinate amount of time on Google and various strategies of getting one by one information. But then when we got 95% correct for, say, a practice like Vituity, they didn't want to be 95% correct. They want to be 100% correct because we are kind of a front door to their practice, right? And so they want everything to be correct. So then they started feeding us information, and several large groups are already doing that, and more every week. On the physician side, there's also network effects in that physicians realize that it's the best way to find information about emergency medicine practices, and then share that information. That's how we're growing. We're growing organically there, but they also give us feedback about things like salaries. We have over 1,000 physician entered salaries in our database, and so we get lots and lots of information from our customers on both sides of the market.
Okay, so you've been live now for 3 years. What has been the biggest change in your business plan? We all start out, as you've alluded to several times, I think very, very well, that we all start out with an idea, and it's kind of like Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And have you been punched in the face with this business? Have there been assumptions or ideas that you had that just never really came to fruition? And maybe you could talk about some of those and how you dealt with that.
Oh, yeah. So the biggest one was our whole business model, right? So we kind of trapped ourselves with our business model in that recruiting sites, whether it's a job board or a company like Weatherby or Jackson Coker, the hirer of doctors pays for the hiring of that doctor, right? So the employer would pay the firm or would pay the job board. And so that was always the assumption. We would charge for value creation. Well, we got a few contracts, and then we realized that doesn't make sense with what we're building, because the service that we are providing for the doctors on one side of the market is that we have all of the emergency medicine jobs. So every emergency department, every group, every job is on Ivy. Well, if we start charging for access, so if, say, Team Health is on Ivy, but because they're paying to be on Ivy, but Envision isn't on Ivy because they're not paying to be on Ivy, well, now do we have a platform that's all the emergency medicine jobs without Envision? That doesn't make any sense. And so we had to totally like etch-a-sketch our business model, because the hard side of the market is the doctors. We've always had our true north to provide the right service to the doctors. And so we had to totally scrap our business model. And we're actually still free for both sides of the market. We're finally going to be charging for job posts in a freemium type of a model. starting mid-June. Finally okay. there, two and a half years into this.
Okay. So you've got two customer bases, or maybe three, right? You have health systems that have their own ER groups. You have the large emergency management corporations, and large and small. And then you have the providers who are currently looking for jobs. So how do you market to those three different customer bases? Where do you go to find the people looking for jobs? Where do you go for the people with the jobs? You mentioned your early strategy, but has that changed over the course of the last 3 years?
Right. And how do we do it with essentially $0? Mm-hmm. Right. So not an easy, I would love to hire Amy Cathy and come up with our marketing strategy. But we've essentially had to become the news, right? So to be out there without paying to be out there, we have to organically build something that gets people's attention. Mm-hmm. On the physician side, that turned into the Emergency Medicine Workforce newsletter, which I write about every 2 to 3 weeks about the business of emergency medicine. And I post a lot on LinkedIn. I try to get the message out about the emergency medicine. And what that does is creates a brand of Leon Edelman, which then people are like, oh, Leon Edelman. And then they connect the brand of Leon Edelman to the brand of IV clinicians, hopefully. And then they go to IV clinicians and then they realize, hey, this is a really cool platform to find jobs. And they tell their friends about it. And that's our core marketing strategy on the physician side. We've also done things like send an Ivy branded chocolate bar to every emergency medicine resident in the United States. We did that and it seemed to work. And there are companies that do that for like $3 a chocolate bar. So that was cool. But again, that costs real money.
Right.
On the employer side, it's basically our strategy is using applications as our core marketing tool. Like I was describing before, we kind of hacked that employer side recruiter information. And so when emergency physicians say you're an emergency physician and you apply through IV for Wilson Medical Center, which is where I do my clinical work now in Eastern North Carolina, it's a team health site. So team health recruiter starts getting applications through this thing, IV clinicians, and they're free, and the people coming through are really good. They're like, hey, what's this IV clinicians thing? This is really helpful. And we then use the physician applicants and applications as our core marketing strategy.
So when you were starting up your business, I noticed that you're the co-founder of IV Clinicians. How did you find the person that co-founded the company with you?
Yeah, I have to say, finding Matt is like a freaking godsend. This would not have worked if Matt and I had not connected. So one of the funny stories in getting this started was I had this idea. I wrote our 25-page business plan that has very little to do with what we are doing now, because all business plans change a lot once you actually start implementing it. But so I had this plan, and I started meeting with people in the software world because I knew a decent amount about emergency medicine. I knew almost nothing about building a software company or a marketplace or anything like that. So I started meeting with everybody that I could in the Raleigh-Durham area. And one of the pieces of advice that I got was, so I was at lunch with this guy who had sold his HR tech company, and he says, make sure not to bring in an old chief technology officer. And I was like, so this guy's about 30. I was like, what do you mean by old? And he says, like, I don't know, 40? And here I am, 42 years old. And I'm like, we definitely have different ideas of what old means. And the reason that he was saying that was a company like what I was trying to create really can't afford a successful 40-year-old software engineer, right? And so if you hire a 40-year-old who's willing to work with me, they're going to be an unsuccessful 40-year-old. You don't want an unsuccessful 40-year-old. You want a yet-to-be-discovered 25-year-old who is looking to build their second companies. And so I happened to meet Matt Simpson, my co-founder. We went to the same high school, except he was about 2 years old when I graduated high school. And it's been great. He's an amazing software developer and really is a great leader of people. And what that's allowed us to do is build the company in parallel while working closely together. So I have no idea how he creates what he creates. He has no idea of what the market of emergency medicine should look like. And so we don't step on each other's toes while we build the two sides of this company.
Okay.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. You mentioned your emergency medicine workforce newsletter, and I know we talked in preparation for the show that you have had several different ways to reaching out to the workforce. One was you started doing a podcast, and I know you had a podcast for both physicians and advanced practice professionals. But now it sounds like you're focusing pretty much on the newsletter to communicate ideas and topics that are germane to the workforce. Tell me a little bit about how that all came about. And I'm interested in moving into the conversation about that we're going to be talking about in terms of the issues going on in the healthcare space right now with private equity and all those kinds of things coming into the space in ways that we've never seen in the past.
Yeah, so pretty quickly after starting Ivy, we realized a few things. One is that we have data that just wasn't out there before, and so we wanted to share that data with the broader community. And the other is that the emergency medicine business, the business of emergency medicine is just fascinating. There's so many little angles to dig into and find information about things like the American Physician Partners bankruptcy and Envision bankruptcy and the challenges that the organizations within emergency medicine like ASAP and AEM and EMRA have had over the last year or two. Really have been fascinating to dig into. And basically the newsletter is me exploring one topic to a significant depth and then sharing that with the broader community and sharing it in a way that the perspective is always from the perspective of a working doctor so that they can have a better sense of the business that they're in.
So the topic of the show today is, you know, the physician practice consolidation. Basically, we're seeing a lot of examples across many segments of healthcare industry where private equity is kind of flowing into healthcare. I was just looking on MedPage Today yesterday, and there was an article with Lisa Kahn, who's the chair of the Federal Trade Commission, and she was talking about how the FTC is really beginning to focus on private equity companies that are investing in healthcare, and she referenced an anesthesia monopoly, quote unquote, where they were actually suing an anesthesia company under the Federal Trade Commission rules and regulations. Is that similar to what we're seeing in emergency medicine, or are you familiar with that anesthesia case at all?
Yeah, that case is fascinating, and one of the nice things about it is that it makes public what otherwise would be private discussions in a room somewhere that those of us on the outside would never hear. And so the case is FTC versus U.S. Anesthesia Partners and Welsh Carson. Though just last week, dismissed Welsh Carson from the case, mostly because Welsh Carson, which is the private equity investor slash owner of U.S. Anesthesia Partners, is actually a minority owner and owns and has a minority of the seats on the U.S. Anesthesia Partners board. And so the judge basically said, we can't prove that that this minority owner is fully liable for the behavior of the portfolio company, USMC's or partners. So it's basically FTC versus USMC's or partners. Well, what did USMC's or partners do that led to this lawsuit, or what are they alleged to have been doing? The first step was consolidating the several markets within Texas. So the strategy was a large anesthesia practice within these metro areas, and then build from there. And so they would acquire other anesthesia groups within the market. By doing that, they kept raising their power vis-a-vis the insurers, because they were bigger and bigger and bigger. And so each new practice could come in and raise their rates more compared to how they had been negotiating their rates prior to joining US Anesthesia Partners. And then you end up with a group that controls more than 50%, significantly more than 50% of some of these metro areas. Where they kind of went past the line from just sort of scaling up a business, right? So we all know about health systems that have more than 50% of the market in their region. That's certainly far from unheard of. What they did that led to the lawsuit was starting, or at least they are alleged to have colluded with other anesthesia groups to not compete against each other, and colluded with them on pricing with insurers. They also, within lawsuits like this, there are always some like calls where it's like, I can't believe they said that. There's like an email from an executive that was titled "Cha-ching" about how they were going to wring money out from the insurers. And then the lawsuit talks in a lot of detail what their strategy was to raise rates from insurers. Basically, what they would do is they would say, we do not want to go out of network. We're not like Envision used to be, where the strategy was just be out of network and send set balance bills to directly to patients. We don't want to do that. We want to stay in network. We are going to negotiate for a very high rate. And if you, the insurance company, do not agree to our very high rate, we will go out of network. And the theory was they had a dominant enough market position that patients would be so mad at the insurance company for not being in network with most of the anesthesiologists within that metro area, that the patients would essentially force the insurer to go back in network, and then they would have a negotiated rate that was super high.
So they, unlike some of the emergency management companies, were using the threat of going out of network as their negotiating ploy.
Correct.
So you mentioned the word pricing as well. Now, pricing in healthcare is different than pricing in a lot of other industries, right? So talk to me a little bit about that. How high did this U.S. anesthesia company have to raise their charges in order to get the impact on their revenue that they were looking for?
So in the lawsuit, there are redactions. And so the numbers like that are redacted from the lawsuit. So I don't see the exact number. Yeah, so I don't have that. The prices actually paid, like you're saying, have nothing to do with price, list price. Healthcare is much more like a Middle Eastern bazaar, where prices are flying here, there, and everywhere, and you're not really sure what you're going to end up paying for that rug. That's more like healthcare.
Right. So most companies, when they're charging the payers, even when we charge Medicare, right, we talk about what percentage of Medicare are we charging? And in some cases, that can be 200% of Medicare. It can be 250% of Medicare. Be interesting to know how high they were able to push their charges as a percentage of what the allowable Medicare reimbursement was to some of these companies based on this strategy that they had.
The one peg or one data point that we can point to now because of the No Surprises Act is that the federal government releases the results of arbitration for the No Surprises Act. And provider organizations arbitrating over professional fees are winning at a rate of 70-75% when they're in arbitration versus the insurers. They're winning the vast majority of the time. And most of the, so the average payment in the No Surprises Act arbitration is about 2.5 times Medicare, is higher than average in-network rates. So the providers are actually doing pretty well through arbitration. That being said, arbitration has some massive problems, structural problems, because of the way it was set. As far as I can tell, any enforcement of insurers having to actually, once there's a decision, oh, you owe $1,000 for this level 5 visit or whatever it is, that they actually pay that. So payment has been both the decision causes a delay, but then the payment gets delayed. So there's a large time factor. There's also cost to arbitration for each of these cases. So it's an administrative headache, but doctors are winning arbitration and winning at a significantly higher rate than they otherwise would in negotiation with the insurer.
So the No Surprises Act came out, what, 2 years ago now? Year and a half ago?
Yeah, it went live January 1st, 2022.
Okay. So it's been about a year and a half since it's gone into effect. What are the main specialties that were impacted by the No Surprises Act? And does it really prohibit these companies or individual physicians from going out of network?
Yeah, so No Surprises Act was designed for non-shoppable services within healthcare. So it's mostly emergency medicine, anesthesia, radiology, some surgical codes that are involved in the No Surprises Act, with emergency medicine being the most commonly arbitrated specialty.
Okay. So can you tell us, or is there a way to know, for us to know what the impact to these has been on revenue for emergency medicine, let's say, or anesthesia, if you compare what their average revenue per patient was prior to No Surprises Act versus after? Is there data out there that tells us, or do we have to kind of make some assumptions about how big the impact has been? I know you mentioned there's two emergency management companies that have gone bankrupt since No Surprises Act. So it's clear that may have played a role, but I'd like to know your thoughts on that as to how big of a role this change in legislation had.
Yeah, it's been a massive disruptor to the emergency medicine employer landscape billing. Or the New York Times article that said, this is the company that does most of the billing. They really were the poster child. The average KFF data looking at this in the 2018 timeframe, the average for the whole country was about 18% of emergency medicine bills were out of network, and Vision was more like 60-70%. So basically their business model was built on going at it. So when the No Surprises Act went into effect, it was a massive hit for Envision, and in May 2023, Envision went bankrupt. The next one down was American Physician Partners. So American Physician Partners on there. So there's a slide deck that's still on the internet somehow of their like last ditch effort to raise money before they went bankrupt. All their financials are now public through this slide deck. And in that deck, they say that about 30% of their revenue prior, so November 2020 going into effect, about 30% of their revenue was from out-of-network billing. And so when, and even then they were still losing money. It's really like an unbelievably, to lose that much money in acute care medicine before the No Surprises Act while being out-of-network at that level, it is kind of mind-boggling, but they did it somehow. So yeah, so they were out of network and losing money, and then No Surprises Act happens, and they just ran out of money and never really had it. As far as I can tell, never really had a plan for how they were going to make it.
Interesting. So at least in those two cases, they were both heavily dependent upon out of network billing in those two companies. Are they outliers as compared to the rest of the emergency management companies out there today?
So the flip side is SCP Health, which used to be called the Schumacher Clinical Partners. That's what the SCP comes from. So SCP is actually in fairly strong financial shape. They don't have a huge amount of debt comparatively. Their leverage is like 5x. But they were largely out of network as well. What was different with them is, first of all, they decreased a lot of administrative overhead, but also were really aggressive in No Surprises Act arbitration, and they've won 90% of their arbitration cases. So they were really aggressive, really early, and have kept that ship afloat by using arbitration. It is doable to adjust from previously having a out-of-network strategy to a post No Surprises Act world without going bankrupt. Then there are others who didn't have any debt, and so they were maximally able to adjust because they could adjust salaries, and that's all they had to do. They adjusted the inflow and outflow and kept going. So Vituity is the largest group in emergency medicine that did not take on debt to grow.
Okay. And you mentioned that SCP had a 5X. Maybe explain that a little bit to people in the audience who don't understand what a 5X debt ratio is, I think it's called.
Yeah. So it's the ratio of debt to earnings. And so if you have a large multiple, it means that your ability to pay off that debt with the earnings that you have is diminished. So like right now, at least as of the last analysis by the ratings agencies, Sound Physician has a 23x leverage, whereas SCP is at 5. And so SCP is much better able to pay off its debt than Sound Physician.
So are all of the major companies, Team Health, SCP, Sound, you mentioned those three, Vituity, are they all owned by private equity firms?
So the ones that are left that are private equity owned in emergency medicine are Team Health, SCP, and Sound. Emergency Care Partners has a minority investment by a private equity company, but their physicians own the majority of that company. Envision was owned by KKR, but KKR lost all of its equity in the bankruptcy process. So Envision now is owned by the lenders to KKR. So it's just a bunch of banks. U.S. Acute Care Solutions is about 95% owned by physicians, 100% owned by their physicians.
So we have a situation where two of the largest emergency medicine management firms go bankrupt. But how have these two bankruptcies impacted, from what you've seen, the physicians who are currently working for companies who are highly leveraged in that way, now that the No Surprises Act is there? Are you seeing an impact on your IV clinicians business? Are more people seeking jobs outside of those large, heavily leveraged companies?
So this is another yes, however. So the market for independent physicians or locum tenens physicians is growing rapidly. So 7 to 10% increase year over year in locum tenens market. So that's telling you, you know, there are more doctors looking to just sort of be out from any contract management group. The percentage of the market employed by the large staffing firms hasn't gone down. So most of APP contracts went to other big staffing firms like SCP and Team Health. You're right that a few, like CHS, a few of them in-house their staffing, but mostly it was just the other bigs getting bigger.
Interesting. I would have thought maybe there was a little bit more of an impact, but I didn't know. That's interesting. course.
Yeah, it all depends on how you define U.S. acute care solutions, right? So they're physician-owned but largely indebted. They are the fastest, now that APP is bankrupt, U.S. acute care solutions is the fastest growing emergency medicine group, really along with SEP. SEP is growing quite rapidly as well.
So into any vacuum, there will be growth, right? It's just I wasn't sure whether even the hospitals that were impacted by APP bankruptcy, I mean, they were only given 2 weeks' notice. And I would imagine that some of the leadership in those organizations must have been significantly concerned about signing a contract with another company that could be a deja vu event for them.
So, yes, you could imagine that these 130 or so hospital CEOs who had to staff their 1.5 weeks after being told that their staffing firm was going to cease operations went into panic mode. But emergency medicine is a competitive market, and there were plenty of companies willing those contracts. So like U.S. Acute Care Solutions got most of their contracts within that first weekend. They were ready to go. They presumably had some inkling that this was going to happen. And within 2 days, bam, they had 18 new contracts. Those that were less sure of a stable new company coming in, like CHS has mostly rural southern hospitals, they decided it was safer not to outsource and did the insourcing thing. A lot of people are thinking that is basically it was buying time to make sure that they could staff their ERs and those contracts up for bid again.
Interesting. Well, thank you again for joining us on our Pemba On Demand live stream. I appreciate you being here and taking out time. It sounds like you have a very busy schedule between your writing and running the business and that kind of thing. So I really, really appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Pemba On Demand today with Dr. Leon Edelman. Today we explored how VC or venture capital influences specialty physician groups, the downstream effects on emergency medicine, and some practical tactics for clinicians who are navigating consolidation and transparency. If this episode has sparked ideas for your team, grab the resources in the show notes and share this episode with a colleague and subscribe for more MD, MBA level conversation.
Pemba On Demand is released biweekly every other Thursday and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PembaOnDemand, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.